Hello, and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and this week we get an insider's view of the sexual revolution, a revolution that did not happen by accident. It was really a great work of propaganda that used whatever tools were at hand, from the pop music to the teen war protests of the era. Various 60s and 70s revolutions were turned into tools to advance the sexual revolution, and no movement was more tragically or thoroughly hijacked by the pushers of the sexual revolution than the women's movement. Our guest, Sue Ellen Browder, was an eyewitness to the whole heartbreaking tale. She spent much of the 70s writing for women's magazines, Helen Gurley Brown's Cosmopolitan, the magazine that most sold the sexual revolution to young women, was her home base. And she has a book now, Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. It's published by Ignatius Press. Sue Ellen Browder, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Cy.
Well, let's get a little history straight. So in the 1960s, the birth of the women's movements, but certainly its very rapid expansion into a major movement. How important were contraception and abortion to the women of the 60s women's movement?
Well, in the beginning, feminism didn't even include abortion and contraception in the women's movement. The second wave feminism, it was called, was launched in 1963 by Betty Friedan, who wrote a book called The Feminine Mystique. And in her book at that time, she didn't even mention contraception and abortion. In fact, she was a mother of three children, and she said that the women's movement should include mothers.
So about the same time that The Feminine Mystique was written, another book, Sex and the Single Girl, was written and became very, very instantly, massively popular, Helen Gurley Brown's book. Was that a separate track of the women's movement, or how did these two kind of major works of the early 1960s kind of shape the movement as it went forward?
Those were two separate movements in those days. The sexual revolution, which Helen Gurley Brown wrote, Sex and the Single Girl, that was quite scandalous in those days, that single girls would have sex and actually talk about it. So that was very scandalous in the 60s. The sexual revolution was one entirely separate from the feminist movement that Betty Friedan had started. In fact, Betty Friedan called Cosmo, which the Sex and the Single Girl author launched as a sex rag, if you will.
Yeah.
Betty Friedan called Cosmo quite obscene and quite horrible.
And
so she was very opposed to turning women into sex objects.
And so for you, as a young woman, you get an investigative journalism degree, and did Betty Friedan's kind of view of the women's movement, which was not about contraceptions, abortion, and sexual licentiousness, did that side appeal to you?
Well, it did very much, because when I got into the workforce, I found all sorts of injustices were going on. Women were being fired for being pregnant. Young people forget that today. I was fired for being pregnant. Betty Friedan had been fired for being pregnant. So there were a lot of things that women were finding when we went into the workforce. Help wanted ads in newspapers were divided into help wanted male, all the good jobs, and help wanted female, all the low-paying jobs. So then people don't remember that, but sexual harassment on the job was rampant, and by the way, apparently still is today. That is one thing we haven't changed, possibly because when they joined the feminist movement and the sexual revolution together, then you ended up not fighting that sexual harassment as they should have. But anyway, women were in some states, women couldn't serve on a jury. There were all sorts of things. A married woman couldn't apply for credit in her own name. So working women, when they got into the workforce, were quite unified in wanting to put a stop to all this. So that was where I came in when I saw the feminist movement that was being started, had been launched by Betty Friedan. I was all for that. You know, I was all for feminism.
Yes. Would you say that, after the Second World War, America changed so much, and throughout the 1950s, there was an image of womanhood, but really people had become suburbanized. The country had never been suburbanized like it was in the years following the Second World War. So women were kind of alone in their homes with devices and children. It seems like that was a recipe for unhappiness, but it was being sold as a recipe for happiness.
Right, exactly. But there was more to it than that. When Betty Friedan wrote her book, she surveyed her Smith College graduating class. All of these women who were so dissatisfied then that she surveyed were in their 40s. They'd already raised their children. They were wanting to get back into the workforce. So she portrayed that survey that she did as if it included all women everywhere, when in fact it included women who were in their 40s who had already raised their children. So yes, these women wanted to get back into the workforce. It didn't include young mothers who wanted to stay home with their kids.
And then in wanting to get back into the workforce, these women are then confronted with a workplace, a society that is, I actually am kind of shocked to hear that women couldn't serve on juries in some places. Sue Ellen, I didn't know that.
I know. It's yes.
Yeah. So you get a real sense of this is not a movement rooted just in, I don't know, resentment or selfishness. This is a movement rooted in the fact that there generally genuinely was an unjust situation for women who wanted to move into the workplace.
Exactly. Many law schools and medical schools were closed to women. It was an entirely different time, and people forget that we've won all of these things. So many of these things that the feminists were fighting for in the 1960s were won.
And then, okay, so, but at the same moment, there is this sexual revolution going on, and people like Helen Gurley Brown with Sex and the Single Girl and with Cosmopolitan magazine are selling a very different vision. They're not selling a vision of women attaining justice in the workplace and justice, you know, in government circles and all that, but they're portraying an image of the unattached woman without children, without marriage, engaging in sexual activity, and this being a thrill, really.
Right, but you know, Helen Gurley Brown taught that hard work and sex without the kids will set you free. That was the philosophy.
I see.
That was the kingpin of the sexual revolution. A woman's freedom depended on not having to sacrifice herself for love by becoming a mother. She was going to be free by not being a mother.
So, and you started working for Helen Gurley Brown at Cosmopolitan magazine in what year?
In 1971. Okay. And then I was on staff there for not that long, maybe 6 or 8 months. And then I went freelance and wrote for the magazine for the next 20 years.
So you're there at the very moment where there's a kind of convergence of these two movements into a new kind of feminism that is pro-abortion, pro-contraception, anti-marriage, anti-children. And if my language is too harsh, please correct me.
No, that's correct. That's correct.
You got caught up in that.
I got caught up in it. What happened here is that when I was in 1971, when I was sitting at my little blue desk at Cosmopolitan, what I noticed at that time, and it was obvious to anybody who was there at the time, that the sexual revolution and the women's movement were two dramatically different movements. Okay.
Yes.
Betty Friedan called Cosmo quite obscene and quite horrible, even though Helen Gurley Brown would have loved to have been part of the feminist movement. So when I became a Catholic, I didn't become a Catholic till I was 57, and I began looking back at that and asking, well, how did those two get joined together? How did we get to the point where so many young women today think to be free is to go to college, get a great degree, have a fantastic job, and be as sexually free as possible? How did those two get joined together? And that was the question that led to my writing of this book.
And the answer is, you did it.
Well, I helped. Because what we did at Cosmo was we joined those two we joined them together by saying that all of this feminism and sexual freedom were part of the same package. And how did we do that? we did it a lot through lies and deception. There were a lot of those stories that we told in the 1970s and 80s. We depicted these women who were so sexually free, and they were always had these glamorous careers, and they were hopping into bed and with the first men they met on the first night, and we made these stories up because there weren't that many women out there, especially in the early 70s when I first got to Cosmo, that were actually doing these things, or if they were, they certainly weren't talking about it. So Cosmo was created, actually, those stories, those little parables, if you will, that we invented were sex fantasies for women. They were really sex fantasies. But as women began to read these and absorb this and think that this was the way other women were living, they began to live out those sex fantasies themselves.
I have to say, Sue Ellen, and Sue Ellen Browder is our guest today on Catholic Answers Focus. Subverted is the book. Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. This I actually found very surprising. I didn't, when you get to the part about what it was actually like to work at Cosmo magazine in the 1970s, many of the alleged real people we wrote about, you write, in the magazine were entirely fictitious. Helen, that's Helen Gurley Brown, had even written a set of writer's guidelines suggesting it was fine for us to make up, quote, experts, to quote, and to invent anecdotes from ordinary single women whom she called civilians. The Cosmo girl was not a real person, but a persona. It was all lies.
It was. In fact, recently I found that list. I had kept that for many years, that list that Helen had given us of rules on how to lie. And I didn't have it for a long time. I thought I had lost it. And I found it recently the other day. And I've been telling people about about this thing, where she actually said, you know, if there's an authority, you need an authority to say things if you're not an expert on something. And she says, even if you have to make it up, go ahead and do that.
Wow.
So she said, for example, all therapists are Freudians. Well, or all psychiatrists are Freudians. She says, well, you can't say that. So you can say, according to this therapist at a major university, all psychiatrists are Freudians. Well, of course, that's a lie. I mean, all psychiatrists are not Freudians. But in other words, you just make up an expert to say these things. And then it makes it more authoritative, obviously. I mean, it's a lot, even that, you know, is a lie.
Right. It's, you know, I suppose that we have this idea that major media like Cosmopolitan magazine have a bias, and they promote that bias through, you know, both intentionally and unintentionally. But to be told by someone who was there, it's not just bias. It's out and out deceit.
It was out and out deceit, yes.
That's I really do think that's news, and I suppose it's not going to be reported in many mainstream media places as news. But that to go back to the and I think I let me just throw this out to you, Sue Ellen. In this all this reporting on the sexual abuse that's going on in Hollywood with Mr. Weinstein and all the other things that are now coming out, shouldn't it be part of the reporting to go back to the beginning and say, well, this was a lie from the beginning?
Exactly. That's what this book is about. And you hit it. That's exactly it. It was a lie from the beginning.
And I have to say also, another thing that I found quite surprising in your book and very refreshing was you name names. That you didn't say, oh, well, you know, this happened, you know, there was lying and there was deceit. But you named the names of the people who did it. And I would like you to tell us about a man named Larry Lader and how he plays into this whole story of how young women were lied to and how the sexual revolution hijacked the women's movement.
Okay, well, Larry Lader was the founder of the National Abortion Rights Action League, which was originally the National Association to Repeal Abortion Laws and is now NARAL Pro-Choice America. Okay, we would not even know this man existed, really, if it hadn't been for Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who you probably know.
Yes.
Who was a pro-life leader, had originally been an abortionist who claimed credit for 75,000 abortions, responsibility for 75,000 abortions, before he saw a baby on a fetal monitor and became pro-life. So he blew the whistle, if you will, and told about him, how he and Larry Lader convinced Betty Friedan to insert abortion and contraception into the feminist movement. Okay? And they did it. For one thing, the reason they did it, the way they were able to do it, was that Larry Lader, who again was this founder of NARAL, and his greatest passion was to make abortion legal. He was a Harvard grad. He had been born Jewish, but he never talked about his Judaism. I think he was an atheist. He was good friends with Betty Friedan, but he was also Margaret Sanger's biographer. His greatest passion was to make abortion legal, and he told Dr. Nathanson that they had to recruit feminists to get abortion legalized in America, because it couldn't be men doing this. At that time, in the abortion movement was mostly run by upper-middle-class men, white men. And so if you wanted the abortion to be legalized, he said we had to recruit the feminists, and that's what he did. He convinced his friend Betty Friedan that if she will not get her other rights passed by Congress, if she didn't allow abortion and contraception into her platform. Because think about this, women were being fired for being pregnant. So you can say, it's okay, guys, you know, you can have women in the workforce and you can give them all these rights and everything, because she'll be on the pill, and if the pill fails, she'll get an abortion.
So Betty Friedan then, with some effort on Larry Lader's part, does in fact agree to this. And so there's after being lobbied very hard, and in fact turns around and what appears, at least in the book, to be a betrayal. She betrays other members of the National Organization of Women by putting this up for a vote in a very kind of last minute and surprising way.
Yes. It took me many, many months to find exactly when abortion and contraception were inserted into the National Organization for Women's political platform. But I finally found it when it happened on November 18th, 1967, in the Chinese room of the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. It was on a Saturday, and Betty Friedan sprang that vote as the very last thing to be voted on. They had 8 rights that they voted on that day in National Organization for Women's political platform. Most of those rights were things we would all agree with. They had agreed that a woman should not be fired for being pregnant. She should have full rights to go to college and get a good degree. She should have not lose her maternity benefits. She should have maternity benefits, and she should not lose her benefits when she became pregnant. So there were lots of things these women all agreed on. There were only 2 rights they fought over that night. One was the Equal Rights Amendment, and that one is now history. The other one was the abortion right, and they fought almost until almost midnight over that. It was a wild fight. These women, they were screaming, they were yelling, they were shouting out slogans. It was very intense, and it's all in the book, that one chapter on a fly on the wall of the Chinese room tells all the things that happened, because I got the minutes of that meeting, and so it tells what was actually said in that meeting. I mean, I took excerpts from those minutes. We couldn't include the whole thing, but that's what happened that night. It was a big fight over abortion, and when the dust settled, There were only about 100 feminists in the room that night. And when the dust settled, only 57 people had voted out of 100. And not all those were had left. There were only 57 people that voted to insert abortion into the women's movement. Only 57 people did this. And then Betty Friedan stood up the next Monday morning in front of the press and said, in front of the Washington Post and all the press corps in D.C., and said she was speaking for 28 million women, working women, all the women who wanted to go back to work. She claimed she was speaking for all the women in America, when in fact she was only speaking for 57 people in the Chinese room that night. And that's how, and then the press was not there. So no reporter actually saw the big battle over this that happened. And so what she essentially did, that's how propaganda works.
Yeah.
And the next week on Tuesday, the Washington Post reports has accepted the sexual revolution as part of its platform. I don't have the exact words here, but that's what they were saying.
You have in the book, and I would almost say in your tone of voice talking about it, a sense almost of what could have been, that it didn't have to be this way.
It didn't have to be that way.
And is it recoverable, do you think? Can there be a women's movement that is like the women's movement you experienced as a young woman, that was about justice and not about the destruction of babies in the womb, not about sexual licentiousness and letting go of responsibilities, but a serious movement?
Oh, well, there already is one. It's called the pro-life movement. Now, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. As I was working on this book, towards the end, I began to realize, and it was really almost, it was after the book was published, I started looking back over all of this stuff, and I realized the pro-life family feminist movement represents the genuine, authentic feminism of the 21st century, and it already did, was representing feminism in the 1960s. Because what happened in that meeting that night, with those 57 people voted to insert abortion in the women's movement, one-third of those ardent feminists walked out that night and later resigned from NOW over the abortion vote. One-third. And where did they go? Well, one of those women went on, her name was Betty Boyer, and she called a human life a sacred trust. She wasn't Catholic, but she was Christian. She called a human life a sacred trust, and she said that she went on to found an organization called the Women's Equity Action League. And that Women's Equity Action League did some amazing, amazing work. Even though they only had about 10,000 people in it at any one time, they opened up academia to women. These are pro-life family feminists, Christians, who did this. They opened up academia to women. They forced newspapers to stop running help-wanted male and help-wanted female classified ads. They fought for girls' sports programs in high schools and college. They kept women from being fired for being pregnant by lobbying for the passage of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978. WEAL, W-E-A-L, Women's Equity Action League, nobody's ever heard of it. Even in Cleveland, where Betty Boyer was, I was at a pro-life conference, they hadn't even heard of this woman in their own town, okay? WEAL was also a major player in the passage of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974, which allowed a married woman to apply for credit in her own name, okay? So by 1979, see, this is all unreported. I didn't know this at all until I started really digging into it. By 1979, the National Organization for Women had 100,000 members. And by the late 1970s, by 1979, the National Right to Life Committee, representing the grassroots pro-life family feminist movement had 110 times that many.
Oh.
11 million members.
So how does it make you feel when you see today this feminism being sold? You're not a real feminist if you're not pro-abortion. And
I have to say, it really makes me angry. Because as now that I'm a Catholic and I see the truth of all this and have researched all this, it makes me angry, and it makes me want to tell the pro-life movement. In fact, that's what I'm speaking on now. I'm going around and telling these women, look, you are the pro-life feminists of the 21st century. You represent. It was pro-life feminism that gave us the right to vote. Alice Paul was a Quaker, and she called abortion the ultimate exploitation of women. The early suffragists like Alice Paul, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were pro-life. Pro-life feminism is the original feminism that gave us the right to vote. Pro-life feminism is the branch of feminism that launched the women's movement in the 1960s before it was hijacked by pro-abortion forces in the Chinese Room. Pro-life family feminism, it gave us fought for all of those other things. They fought behind the scenes. Now, why didn't the media ever notice this group? Okay, you'd think somebody would have noticed.
Well, I have to say, Sue Ellen, I would think that, but I read your book, and if people are willing to just outright lie, then there's no reason why they wouldn't be willing to just ignore facts that may be contrary to their agendas.
That's right. That's right. But also, to be fair, I talked to Betty Boyer's niece, and Betty Boyer is now deceased, of course. But her niece said that pro-life family feminists who at Wheel did not want attention. These were professional women who could be fired if their bosses knew that they were out there marching for these causes. And so they just, when the National Organization for Women wanted all of that attention, they said, okay, let them have it. And they were actually happy to be under the radar of the mm-hmm. of the press at that time.
If I could move just for a real quick, Sue Ellen, to your story. Having been a Cosmo girl and having written, these things in the 1970s, and I imagine there was a kind of connection to it as these movements that merged were self-liberation movements, or it became about. As a matter of fact, I remember in the 70s they started calling it the me generation. And
right.
At some point in your life, you apparently, because you just said you became a Catholic at 57, decided that self-liberation wasn't the way to go. You needed someone else to liberate you. Can you just give us an idea of how that happened?
Well, it was a long journey, actually. My beloved husband wanted to become a Catholic. I think he had a Catholic sensibility all his life. And I didn't want to become a Catholic at all. We had come north, Northern California, and the Episcopal Church that we belonged to at that time was really kind of disintegrating. And so Walter said, well, maybe we should become Catholics. And I'm like, I'm not going to join that patriarchal old church, right?
Yeah.
But as we began to look into it, we began to look closer and closer. We went to a Catholic church. The service, this was kind of the service, after Vatican II, especially up here in Northern California, was very much like an Episcopal service. There wasn't much difference, and except, of course, the Eucharist, which is all the difference, okay? But anyway, I was very taken by this little Catholic church, and then the priest told us to get the catechism. And I read that catechism the day I got that. I couldn't put it down. I read it for 3 days straight. This was not the patriarchal old Catholic church I'd heard about. This was about joy and beauty and love. And I was just mesmerized. I just fell head over heels in love with the Catholic Church. And my beloved husband, Walter, we were married 40 years. He died in 1988, well, on New Year's Eve, of not 1988, 2008. I now live on the church property right next door to my priest. And I take care of his fish and water his orchids when he goes out of town.
So it has come, so the liberation that you experience in relationship with Christ in as part of the church, it's a different kind of liberation.
And it's a true liberation. You know, before we became Catholic, I was always anxious, and my moods would alternate between anxiety and depression, and I didn't know why. In fact, I even called myself at one time Big Sue and Little Sue. Little Sue was the one who was always crying inside, and Big Sue was the one that was trying to comfort her. When I came into the Catholic Church, I realized Big Sue and Little Sue are together, and the church is God is taking care of both of them.
That's striking to me, because so much of what's happening in our society all around us is a kind of disintegration because of the person. The idea of the person is not an integrated view of the person. This is not really what a person is. A person is not just someone who uses other people like exercise equipment for sexual gratification. A person is not someone who, you know, it's all about me. And so what you found in the Catholic Church is a reintegration of yourself.
Of course, and that's what you always will find. You find a reintegration of yourself because you've found the truth of God, and it's just the most beautiful thing. I have to say, my income dropped from about $80,000 or $90,000 a year down to $14,000.
Hey, maybe that's not a selling point. I don't know if you want.
You can cut that if you want.
Well, congratulations on that.
But, listen to me, how happy I am.
Yeah.
The happiness and it is just overwhelming. I found a joy that I didn't even know existed. And I had a beautiful marriage, and I had two lovely children, but this is a joy beyond joy. It is just the most amazing thing, and it's all worth the price. It's all worth the price.
It's such a great pleasure to talk with you after having read the book, and I've been recommending it to other people because I think you do something that has not been done, Sue Ellen. Sue Ellen Browder, our guest, in the book Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. And the thing that you do that has not been done is you tell the story with details, as I said, with names, with dates, with places. This is how it happened that a movement for justice for women became a movement that degrades everyone, with from the death of children in the womb to all this, you know, continued sexual harassment that we can't really speak about because we have this false narrative of what a human being is and what it is to be liberated. You name the names, you give the dates, you tell the real story of what happened, Sue Ellen Browder, and I myself am eternally grateful that you have done it. And thank you so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much to our listeners. We do appreciate that you listen. Please tell other people about Catholic Answers Focus. And if you'd like to be part of our radio club, if you go right now to our radio club website, we're going to give you a free talk, what the Reformation was all about, with Jimmy Akin's talk on the Reformation, what the Reformation was all about. You can have it for free by joining the radio club. And we don't bother you with a lot of emails either. Just go to catholic.com/radio club. This is Cy Kellett. This is Catholic Answers Focus, and we'll see you next time, God willing.